Disclaimer. The information shared on this podcast is intended for entertainment purposes only. It should not be considered as professional advice or a substitute for seeking professional advice. The topics discussed in this episode are dark in nature and may be distressing to some listeners. We will be exploring sensitive subjects, including domestic violence, severe fire burns, and murder, which may not be suitable for all audiences. Listener discretion is strongly advised. On this episode of Loveless Fridays, Michelle and I sat down with Gina and Amber of Weird True Crime to discuss the tragic murder of Judy Malinowski. We're going to present the story as covered on Weird True Crime, followed by an all-new episode of Loveless Fridays, where we delve deeper into the case and share details that weren't part of the original episode.
Fire Eyes Media.
Welcome back, y'all. It's the middle of January, and we are not on hiatus. In fact, we have so much more in store for you, it's not even funny. And we're celebrating a huge milestone today. This is the 100th episode of Weird True Crime. Triple freaking digits. It's pretty amazing that we're here. And for those of you who are new here, I'm Gina.
And I'm Amber.
And we're longtime besties who are now your new bestie. If you've been around a while, thank you for sticking with us over the last couple of years. We wouldn't be here without you. And for the newbies, I don't normally sound like this, but this cold weather is kicking my ass and my voice along with it. So bear with me.
Before we dive in today's case, we need to ask for your help. It would mean the world if you could take a minute to rate us 5 stars and leave a review for the show wherever you listen. Positive ratings help us grow and give us the ability to keep sharing more stories. And we have a lot of important stories to share this year. Share it with a friend, follow us on social media at Weird True Crime, and subscribe to Weird True Crime on YouTube for even more content. Okay, now let's get into today's case.
So, picture this. A woman is hanging out behind a gas station parking lot, hiding from her on-again, off-again boyfriend, when tensions escalate and she's doused in gasoline and set on fire. It sounds unreal, right? But this really happened. And the victim, Judy Malinowski, didn't let her story end there. She made sure her voice was heard and turned her pain into something bigger, a push for justice.
All right, so Judy Malinowski was born Judith Ann Hensel on August 26, 1983 in Ohio. Life seemed pretty normal for her as a kid, but things took a hard turn when her dad passed away in 1997. She was just 13 years old at the time, and losing him left a big hole in her life. Even with that loss, Judy kept pushing forward. She was friendly, active, and the kind of person everyone wanted to be around. She went to New Albany High School and graduated in 2001. During her time there, she was crowned Homecoming Queen and Miss New Albany. But it wasn't just about the titles for Judy. People genuinely liked her because she had this knack for making others feel seen and valued. After high school, she continued her journey at Ohio State University. Not long after, she married Ron Malinowski, and they had 2 daughters together. Her girls became her entire world. Everything she did was for them. But things with Ron weren't easy. Their marriage hit some major bumps, especially when Ron cheated. That betrayal marked the beginning of the end for their relationship. They ended up separating, but never went through a formal divorce. Despite everything, Judy kept her focus on being a mom. She poured all her energy into making sure her daughters had the best life possible.
And then, as if life hadn't already been hard enough, Judy got hit with another blow in her early 20s. ovarian cancer. After initially making a full recovery, Judy received the devastating news that the cancer had returned in 2006, when she was just 23 years old. The diagnosis meant that she had to undergo a hysterectomy, and while that was physically and emotionally tough, it also led to something even more challenging. Judy started relying on pain medications to get through her recovery, and before she knew it, she was dealing with an addiction. It's the kind of thing that can derail anyone's life, but Judy wasn't the type to give up. She knew she had to fight it. She ended up going to rehab and worked hard to reclaim her life. It wasn't an easy road by any stretch of the imagination, but she had her daughters, and they were her reason to keep going. That determination was just who Judy was, resilient and always striving to do better, no matter how tough things got. I couldn't imagine being diagnosed with ovarian cancer at like 20 years old.
And it coming back a second time.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
Come on. That's just not fair, man.
It's really not. And it makes, I don't know, there's nothing about it, but I don't know if maybe cancer was prevalent in the family. And so maybe she just, like, her risks were higher. But thank goodness she had already had her daughters, because having to have a hysterectomy, she couldn't have any more children.
Yep.
But yeah, she did not have a good lot in life. Like, that's tough. And I was doing a little bit of digging into the likelihood of getting addicted to your pain medications in this situation. And according to the American Medical Association, an estimated 3 to 19% of people who take prescription pain medication develop an addiction to them. I don't know why it's such a big, like, 3 to 19. That's kind of
it's a big range.
A big range. But even 3%, that's a lot of people.
That's a lot of people.
It is, and I know people personally who did get addicted to their pain medications, and it's a really hard addiction to beat.
Oh yeah.
So good for her for working her way to sobriety.
Sometime between Judy's first and second battle with ovarian cancer, she met a construction worker named Michael Slager. Despite being 8 years older than her, Michael and Judy became close friends. In fact, Michael was the one who told Judy that her husband Ron was cheating on her. Michael didn't waste much time taking advantage of Judy's separation from Ron. He admitted he'd been in love with her for a while and saw this as the perfect opportunity to share his feelings. But there were some obvious red flags. For one, Michael was dating several of Judy's friends at the time. Oh, and Judy was pregnant with her and Ron's second daughter. To top it off, Michael ended up going to prison not long after confessing his feelings. Let's just say it wasn't exactly the makings of a love story. Still, years later, Judy and Michael would eventually end up dating, a decision that, sadly, would lead to devastating consequences.
Some point after her second battle with ovarian cancer and hysterectomy, which led to her addiction to pain medication, like we said, Judy lost her health insurance. This meant that she could no longer afford to go to the doctor or pay for the prescriptions, so she started using heroin. According to the American Medical Association, 45% of heroin users were initially addicted to prescription opioids. That's a lot of people. And because Judy could no longer safely take care of her daughters, her mom, Bonnie, and her sister kept them. Thankfully, Judy went to a private rehab facility, got sober, and began living with her daughters again.
That just shows the strength that she has, that she recognized and went and got herself help.
Mm-hmm. I didn't look into this aspect of it, but now, of course, it just popped into my head. I wonder why it is that so many opioid addicts turn to heroin, specifically.
From my understanding and what I've experienced from others in my life, whenever you're addicted to an opioid like that, your body almost develops kind of a tolerance to it. So it requires more and more for you to get that relief or, you know, whatever the reason it is you're taking it that you're needing. And so it gets to a point to where you're taking so much, it's just not doing what it needs to. And so people have to up the ante, and then they turn to other things like heroin.
Heroin terrifies me. Oh, and not because of the needle. It's just terrifying. And you see what it does to people.
Seeing how somebody behaves while on heroin is terrifying.
And how it changes them. Like the pictures you see of somebody before and after.
The mental and physical changes are terrifying.
Yeah, it's so sad.
She was doing really well. The best she'd been in a while. But then she began dating Michael Slager in April 2015 after they reconnected on Facebook. Remember, Judy and Michael were friends previously. But Judy was pregnant with her second daughter and Michael went to prison. At first, things seemed okay. Michael came across as supportive, and Judy, who was still working to get back on her feet after years of struggles, welcomed the help. There was a side of Michael that wasn't immediately obvious. He had a criminal record, and not just minor offenses. We're talking domestic violence, stalking, sexual battery, and more. It's unclear if Judy was aware of the extent of Michael's criminal history, but it painted a clear picture. This was not a safe person. According to Judy, after they went on their first date, Michael basically moved himself into her house. As their relationship continued, the facade quickly fell apart. Michael was controlling and abusive, but he wasn't just physically violent, he was emotionally manipulative, too. Judy's family began noticing bruises on her arms and face, and at one point, Judy told her sister Michael had choked her. And Michael's control and abuse didn't end there. He encouraged Judy to relapse into using drugs, something she had worked so hard to overcome. Why? Well, because it gave him power over her. Her mom, Bonnie, saw what was happening and tried desperately to intervene, but Michael's grip on Judy was strong. He isolated her, cut her off from support, and made her feel like there's no way out. According to the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services, this type of abuse is called substance abuse coercion. It's a barrier to victims' economic stability because it can affect their finances, employment, housing stability, social networks, and public benefits for which they are eligible.
And a survey from the National Domestic Violence Hotline showed that 43% of respondents had experienced at least one of three types of substance abuse coercion. So they either had a partner pressure or force them to use substances, like what happened to Judy, had a partner threaten to report their substance use to the authorities to keep them from getting something they want or need, and or were afraid to call the police because a partner said they would not be believed or they would be arrested based on substance use, and which we'll see is something that Michael used to his advantage as well. And the fact that he moved in basically immediately, like as soon as they started dating, he just inserted himself into her life like that. He was like, okay, cool. Now I'm in and I can just sink my claws into this woman who's not necessarily the most stable because she's dealing with so much. And he saw it as like, oh, this is an easy target. 100%. And he was not a drug user either. He's just getting her to stay on those drugs so he can continue to manipulate her. Oh, it's disgusting. And the fact that so many people do that to their partners seems like the absolute opposite of what you would want to do. But there's a lot of not great people out there. Between May and July of 2015, the police were called to their home 13 times. Let that sink in. 13 times in just a few months. And believe it or not, most of those calls were made by Michael. In the documentary, The Fire That Took Her, detectives explained that Michael's calls to the police were a way to assert control. He used law enforcement as a tool to maintain power over Judy. And the situations varied from verbal arguments to physical altercations, but Michael always managed to avoid serious consequences. For example, the first time police were called, it was because Michael and Judy had gotten into a fight and Judy took his car. Even though Michael made the call, he didn't want to press charges. It was part of a strategy. Involved the police just enough to keep Judy under his thumb, but not enough to face any repercussions himself.
Judy herself made some of those calls, including one particularly chilling 911 plea where she said, "Michael's going to kill me. I need help." Despite this, Judy later testified that the detectives at the scene didn't take meaningful action to protect her. In contrast, the officers interviewed in the fire that took her claimed they spoke to Judy about what was happening and offered help, but Judy was too scared to press charges. Michael had convinced her that going to the police would only make things worse. She feared for her life and for her daughter's safety if Michael found out she had spoken to law enforcement. Judy did try to escape. Once she fled to a hotel, thinking she could finally break free. Michael had been beating her and treating her horribly. She stayed there for nearly a week, hiding and trying to figure out her next steps. Judy's mom, Bonnie, was also trying to get her away from Michael during this time. But Michael wasn't going to let her go that easily. He tracked her down, showed up at the hotel, and convinced her to come back. It's hard to imagine the fear and hopelessness she must have felt in that moment. For Judy, it wasn't just a bad relationship. It was a nightmare she couldn't wake up from. Yeah, you just feel stuck, stranded, completely hopeless. Like, there's absolutely nothing that I can do. And if I try to do anything, he's going to hurt me or the people I love most in this entire world.
Right, and the authorities aren't going to take me seriously because he's just going to talk his way out of it, or I'm the one that's going to get in trouble because of this substance abuse, and my kids' lives are at stake here. So,
yep,
she's just
not worth it.
No. Then came August 2nd, 2015. It started like any other day, but it quickly turned into a nightmare Judy couldn't escape. That morning, she got news that should have been life-changing in a good way. A bed had opened up at a rehab center. This was her chance to get help, to turn things around. Michael drove her to the facility and dropped her off, but she hesitated. She stood outside, bummed a cigarette from someone, and stalled. She wanted to talk to her mom and daughters before checking in, to make sure they were okay with her decision. So instead of walking inside, she started heading to meet her mom. And that's when Michael pulled back up and Judy got in his truck. From there, things spiraled fast. They drove to a gas station to buy cigarettes, but the argument that started in the truck didn't stop. By the time they arrived, Michael was extremely upset. Sensing the tension, Judy tried to quietly slip out of the truck and get away. She walked behind the Speedway building, finally sitting down in the grassy area that separated the gas station from a nearby bank, trying to collect herself.
But Michael wasn't about to let her go that easily. He pulled his truck behind the bank, looking for her. When he found her, he threw the truck into park, got out, and started calling her names. The argument went on for 5 to 10 minutes, long enough for anyone nearby to have noticed, but no one intervened. Then, Judy lost her temper and threw her styrofoam cup of soda at him. That's when Michael snapped. In an instant, he grabbed a gas can from the bed of his truck and stormed back toward her. Judy tried to run, but she tripped. That's when he started pouring gas on her, starting from the top of her head and even into her mouth, burning her throat. She gagged and coughed as he continued dumping gasoline all over her body. She screamed for help, but no one came. As she cried out, Michael taunted her. "You want to throw something at me? See what I'll do to you, bitch," he sneered. "How do you like this?"
Oh, I just got chills. Satisfied with his work, he stepped back to look at her. Judy, desperate to de-escalate, scrambled to gather her things and leave. But there was an issue with one of her shoes. In a final attempt to calm him down, she asked Michael for help and told him she'd get back in the truck with him. But Michael had other plans. He reached into his pocket, pulled out a lighter, flicked it on, and walked toward her. Then, he set her on fire.
Flames engulfed her almost instantly. The gasoline acted like an accelerant, turning her into a human torch within seconds. Judy later described the pain as like 1,000 hot needles stabbing her body all at once. She screamed for help, her cries piercing the air, but Michael just stood there, watching her burn. Judy recalled his eyes looking black, and she screamed. In an attempt to put out the fire, she buried her face in the grass and took off her sweatshirt. Nothing helped. The fire had engulfed her so completely, she couldn't see anything, but could hear voices coming from far away. The last thing she remembered before blacking out was praying to God. What do you even say to that? We're both just sitting here shaking our heads.
Should ever have to experience anything like that. And she was a victim in so many ways. Like, she had already gone through so much in her short life at this point, only to go through something like this. You know?
And it's not like she was alone there either.
No.
There were witnesses, but, you know, trying to put myself in the shoes of one of those witnesses. You know, Michael Dude doesn't seem like a very good human being, and probably people gave him a wide berth for that reason.
Absolutely.
So the hell are you gonna do when all of a sudden that all unfolds in front of you?
And there's security or there's camera video from the bank of it. It's surreal.
Yeah.
Surreal. It's like, how is that a person? It
makes it very hard for your brain to comprehend that a human being actually had to go through that.
And survived it. For as long as she did.
Yeah.
I don't know what's worse. Surviving that and living through that agony or not surviving it.
I think that if things didn't play out the way that they're about to in her case, it may not have been worth it. But I think what she was able to do...
Made it worth it. Absolutely. Witnesses at the gas station were horrified. And like you said, Michael is a scary dude. And so they probably witnessed this and were afraid to intervene for their own safety. But once they saw this, they called 911, frantically trying to describe the horrific scene unfolding in front of them. Bystanders later stated it looked like Michael was going to leave after pouring the gasoline on her, but he stomped over to her like he was going to hit her. He did the unimaginable and set her on fire. After one witness made their presence known, Michael ran to get a fire extinguisher and put out the fire, ravaging Judy's body. So it took somebody else seeing this for him to be like, oh shit.
Oh shit, someone saw me.
So I guess I better act like I didn't do this on purpose now. And this gas station was in a busy part of town. This wasn't the kind of place where you'd expect someone to try and murder someone in broad daylight. But that's exactly what happened. When police responded to the call, they thought they were showing up to a small fire, maybe someone with minor burns. But what they found was so much worse. Michael had some burns on his legs from putting out the fire, but he would make a full recovery. Judy, on the other hand, wasn't that lucky.
She was left with burns covering 90% of her body. So something interesting that I learned about the body burning percentages is they actually break down the sections of your body and they give a percentage amount to it. So let's say, for instance, like your torso from like your shoulders down to like your abdomen, that's 9%. Then your stomach is 9%. Mm-hmm. The front of your, both of your legs is 9% each. The back of your legs would be 9%. So each of your legs is 18%. So that's how they determine the percentage of the burns that cover your body. And for somebody to have 90% of that covered, there's maybe like the bottom of her feet wasn't burned. Maybe, you know, lower private area wasn't burned, something like that. Just very, very small percentage of her body that had not been burned. That's a devastating thing to put into perspective when you look at it that way. Her hair and skin were completely scorched. The fire had destroyed her ears, leaving her disfigured in ways that emergency responders said were unimaginable. When Judy's mom, Bonnie, arrived at the hospital, doctors warned her that she wouldn't recognize her daughter. And they were right. She later told 10TV, they were right. It just didn't even look like a human being. But all I could see was my baby in that bed. All I could see was that she was alive. Judy's sister was so overwhelmed by the sight of her that she vomited and fainted on the spot. Burn injuries are not for the faint of heart. And especially covering your entire body in that way, it's an unimaginable torture that no one should ever feel. I mean, we've said the word a few times, but it really just is unimaginable.
And I completely understand why her sister had the reaction that she did. Could you imagine seeing your loved one that you grew up with side by side like that?
No longer even resembling the person that she was?
No.
It's devastating.
And being completely helpless to like do anything about it. You just have to stand there and let her suffer.
Yep.
That's just awful.
Well, it's probably not surprising to hear that Judy's outlook was grim. Doctors didn't think she'd make it through the night. They told her family to prepare for the worst, warning that she might only have hours to live. But Judy was not ready to give up. She clung to life with a strength that shocked even the medical team. For around 7 months, Judy was in a coma. But then she woke up and spent the next 15 months on a grueling journey of survival and, again, unimaginable resilience.
During her time in the hospital, Judy underwent 59 surgeries. Skin grafts to replace the layers of skin destroyed by the fire, treatments to fight off constant infections that threatened her fragile state, and endless rounds of physical therapy.
When you get burned like that, your nerves fully exposed. There is no amount of pain medication or numbing medicine or anything that you can do to give comfort for that person experiencing that. So with the skin grafts and, you know, debriding and cleaning, just absolute constant agony.
Mm-hmm. I read that the amount of pain medication they would have had to give her for it to actually make a difference would have killed her.
Fatal. It's a fatal dose that would actually do anything.
Literally cannot give her pain meds that she needs because it will kill her. The fire had stolen so much from her. She lost her ears, most of her eyesight, and many of her fingers, leaving her unable to perform even the most basic tasks. She couldn't walk, and because of the burns in her airway, she could barely speak. Her body was so fragile that she coded 7 times, and each time doctors fought to bring her back. And yet, despite all of it, Judy faced every procedure, every painful setback, with a determination that left everyone around her in awe. While Judy was fighting for her life, Michael was busy weaving a story for investigators. when questioned, he claimed that Judy had accidentally spilled gasoline on herself while filling up the truck. According to him, when he went to light a cigarette for her, she just went up in flames. Not only that, he tried to paint himself as the hero, going on about how he hurt himself trying to save her. But the cops weren't buying it. The bank next to the Speedway had security cameras facing the grassy area where everything went down. And unlike Michael, cameras don't lie. It's not even a good lie.
I hate this guy.
He's a piece of shit.
I hate this guy.
Like, we try not to say a lot. Go ahead.
No, and I'm sorry for whatever emotional trauma homeboy experienced early on in life that made him the way that he is. But come on, dude.
Well, look, I think we've said this before. You can feel bad for the child version of someone who's gone through immense trauma, right? But that does not justify the actions that they take as an adult.
Placing blame on what happened to them when they were younger.
Correct.
You still are a adult. In this case, you are still an adult man capable of, well, supposed sane thought and rationality.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, probably not good to set someone on fire.
No. And we'll talk about it later. So he did have a couple of mental illness diagnoses. And one of them, I'm not sure if it's really true or if that was just something the defense came up with to justify it, but we can talk about that.
Investigators watch the footage. Surprise, surprise, they're going to watch footage of what happened because people lie.
Mm-hmm.
Michael soaking Judy in gasoline, walking off screen for 32 seconds, then coming back, bending down and lighting her on fire. The video also showed that Michael only ran for the fire extinguisher after he realized people had seen what he did. Oh shit, I can't say I don't know what happened because somebody's literally watching.
Mm-hmm.
To build a solid case, investigators needed to hear from Judy. Oh, this pains me so much. Mm-hmm. Her care team brought her out of sedation just long enough for a brief conversation with officers. When they asked if she had spilled gasoline on herself, she shook her head no. When they asked if Michael did this to her, she nodded yes. That was all they needed to move forward. Not surprisingly, when police spoke to Michael again in his hospital room, his story changed. This time, he claimed that after Judy threw the soda at him, they kept arguing. Then she spit in his face. Oh, the audacity, because throwing gasoline back at her is the appropriate reaction to that response.
Yeah, of course.
He admitted to throwing gasoline on her, saying he was just trying to, quote, quote, even the score, because she ruined his clothes. I don't know if he knew this, but soda washes out. Like, you go to a washing machine and you wash the clothes, and they're fine.
Yeah, I don't know that I would wash and rewear something that had been soaked in gasoline.
No, it's not.
No.
Not exactly even Steven there.
No, it's not.
Well, then he claimed she sat down and asked him for a cigarette. He walked over with the lighter and, well, the rest was history.
Yeah, they didn't buy it. Investigators fully believed Michael had meant to kill Judy, but that wasn't enough to build a murder case. As awful as it sounds, they were playing the waiting game because as long as Judy was alive, they couldn't charge him with murder. They expected her to pass away, but Judy wasn't done fighting. While Judy held on, investigators shifted gears and charged Michael with aggravated arson, felonious assault, and possession of criminal tools. Despite overwhelming evidence, Michael stuck to his accident story. trying to spin Michael as the victim, his lawyer told People magazine that Michael loved Judy and that he was horrifically injured trying to save her and now confined to a wheelchair. All in the name of love. Please.
Oh, I can't.
I just can't. Michael's trial was set to begin in December 2016. But on the morning jury selection was supposed to start, he pleaded no contest to both charges. The judge gave him the maximum sentence, a measly 11 years. The decision to take the plea deal was strategic. It preserved Michael's rights in case he was later charged with murder, and, more importantly, it kept Judy from testifying under oath, something she had been fully prepared to do. During sentencing, the judge didn't hold back, telling Michael, quote, "You really seem like the kind of person that has no soul, and you need to be incarcerated," end quote. And as Bonnie put it, Michael had silenced Judy again. Prosecutors were furious about the 11-year sentence, but their hands were tied. As long as Judy was alive, they couldn't move forward with murder charges. Sadly, doctors had already warned her family that she likely wouldn't survive much longer.
In an interview with 10TV, Judy spoke openly about her suffering, saying, "No human being should ever have to go through what I've been through. Nothing that breathes should ever have to endure the pain of being set on fire." She was fighting for her life, for her daughters, and for her story.
The thing that gets me so much about burn injuries, they are excruciating when it happens. They are excruciating during the healing process, which takes forever. And then it's still excruciating for the rest of your life because mm-hmm. your body has been so horribly altered. Even like, I don't know if you've noticed, but anybody that like gets a severe burn on their hand, but they don't lose fingers, they end up getting like these fibrous connective things between their fingers and almost make their hand unusable because of all of that. I guess it's scar tissue. Basically, you know, the buildup of scar tissue, and because of all of the treatments and everything, the skin grafts, all of that scar tissue builds up. And then even though they still have their fingers, their hand is basically useless because of the burn injury. So mm-hmm. it's not just, you know, you break an arm. That hurts. Healing will hurt. Recovery can be uncomfortable, but that's at least at a level where pain medication can assist.
And it will eventually go away.
And eventually you'll be fine. For the most part, depending on the severity of the break, but it's nothing in comparison to what she was set up to endure for the remainder of her existence on this planet.
No, not to mention that even after you do to all the skin grafts and everything else, all of the nerve damage that's been done, you can't fix that.
No. It's irreparable damage.
Yeah, and if anybody's ever experienced that or like had a surgery or something where nerves in your body get altered, it's a weird sensation, and it can hurt and it can be uncomfortable, and you don't have the same feeling at all anymore in that spot. Could you imagine having no feeling in over 90% of your body?
No.
Besides fucking pain?
No.
She also wanted others to learn from her experience. In that same interview, she urged other women in abusive relationships, saying, "I want to tell people how horrible something like this can be. And if you're in an abusive relationship, find help and get out completely. Run the other way. Run."
You never know when it's going to escalate.
No. And that's why we're telling her story, because it's exactly what she wanted. And it is important for people to know that if they're in this situation, there is help there. There is hope, and you can find a way out, no matter how hopeless it seems.
Yep.
On December 22nd, 2016, Ohio Senator Jim Hughes met with Judy's mom, Bonnie, to discuss his plan to introduce a bill allowing judges to impose longer sentences for assaults that leave victims maimed, disfigured, or permanently disabled. Hughes worked closely with Judy's family, and by the time the bill was introduced to Congress, it had a name: Judy's Law.
By early 2017, Judy knew she didn't have much time. Prosecutors asked her to testify because, under Ohio law, a victim's testimony could be filmed in advance if they were expected to die before trial. But testifying wasn't just a matter of sitting in front of a camera. To make sure her testimony held up in court, Judy had to wean herself off of pain medication for weeks, proving to the judge that she was of sound mind. To say that it was a brutal process is an understatement. There's video of Judy sobbing from the pain, saying she didn't want to do it, but that she had to. On January 26, 2017, Judy spent 3 hours testifying against Michael. Because of the damage to her airway, she needed a speaking valve over her trachea just to be questioned by prosecutors and cross-examined by the defense. Her voice was shaky but firm as she described the horror of being doused in gasoline and set on fire. She disputed Michael's claim that it was an accident. She couldn't recall every moment of that day, but she gave a clear, detailed timeline of the attack itself.
Of course, Michael's defense team did what defense teams do. They grilled Judy about her past, bringing up her history with addiction and choices she made while struggling. They wanted to make her look unreliable, but Judy never wavered. Though exhausted and in unimaginable pain, I don't know how many times we have to say that this time. Last time it was, you know, the bullet in the head. This time it's all the horrible pain she was dealing with. She answered every question honestly, even when it reflected badly on her. As her mother later put it, quote, "Judy was not perfect, but she was human. She was on her way to rehab when this happened." End quote. And not to mention, it shouldn't and doesn't matter that she was struggling with addiction. That doesn't mean she deserved or, you know, no. I don't understand that. It's like, okay, what does it matter how you make her look or talk about the choices she made when she was struggling? That doesn't justify anything. Anything. And then came the moment that would later define the case. The prosecutor asked Judy, "What do you think should happen to Michael if you die from the wounds he inflicted?" Her answer was clear. "I think he should be charged with murder and sentenced to life."
Judy was moved to a palliative care center in May 2017. After nearly 2 years of life-saving surgeries and around-the-clock care, her body was giving out. Her family knew they were running out of time, so they fought to get Judy's Law passed before she was gone. In June, Judy's oldest daughter, just 13 years old, testified in front of an Ohio Senate committee. She told lawmakers that while Michael only got 11 years, her family was handed a life sentence. She urged them to pass the law to prevent horrific crimes like this from happening to others. 7 days later, on June 27th, 2017, Judy passed away from organ failure. She had fought for 696 days. She was only 33 years old. The very next day, the Ohio Senate adopted Judy's Law, And on July 17th, 2017, Ohio Governor John Kasich held a special ceremony where Judy's daughters, now 10 and 13, joined him in signing the bill into law. Under this new law, anyone who uses an accelerant to harm or disfigure someone will face an additional 6 years in prison. If this law had existed when Michael was sentenced, he would have received a maximum of 17 years instead of 11. Still not enough, but definitely a step forward.
After Judy's official cause of death was ruled a homicide, Michael was charged with murder and became eligible for the death penalty. But on July 5th, 2018, just one day before his trial was set to begin, Michael took a plea deal. He pleaded guilty to aggravated murder, even though he originally wanted to plead no contest, which means he wouldn't admit guilt but wouldn't dispute the charge either. But the judge wouldn't allow it. They wouldn't allow him to plead no contest.
Good.
And the guilty plea took the death penalty off the table, but sentenced him to life without parole, which is what Judy wanted. In court, Michael admitted to soaking Judy in gasoline and setting her on fire. He claimed he was on medication for bipolar disorder and had intermittent explosive disorder, which can cause uncontrollable rage. According to Healthline.com, there's a term called bipolar abuse, which refers to situations where people with bipolar disorder act abusively toward a partner, often triggered by mania or depression. That's a dangerous combination. If he really had both disorders, and you can prove that, he had bipolar disorder, especially if he had been prescribed medication for it in the past.
Yeah.
Who knows if he was actually taking the medication or not at the time. And I hate to do that or make any assumptions, but I do wonder if he really did have this intermittent explosive disorder, or if that was something that his defense team found and used as a way to explain away his reaction. But I am not a doctor, and so I can't really say one way or the other.
That still doesn't justify.
No, it doesn't.
Somebody on fire.
Absolutely not. During the hearing, Judy's recorded testimony was played, making her the first person in history to testify in her own murder trial.
That is monumental if you think about it. Bonnie also spoke in court, revealing that Judy didn't want Michael to get the death penalty, not because he didn't deserve it, but because she was a forgiving person. Judy wanted Michael to not face the death penalty. Her hope was that he would find God somewhere between now and when he meets her. That was her hope, and that was very generous of her.
But Judy's case became more than just a legal battle. It sparked conversations about domestic violence, systemic failures, and the need for stronger protections for victims. Her family's relentless fight for justice ensured that Judy's legacy would extend far beyond the courtroom. Her courage, telling her story from a hospital bed, set a historic precedent and gave hope to countless others trapped in similar cycles of abuse. Beyond the law, Judy's family created Judy's Foundation, an organization dedicated to supporting families affected by domestic violence, drug abuse, and human trafficking. According to judysfoundation.org, they are working to develop software for first responders to better handle cases involving abusers, expanding and strengthening Judy's Law, and creating Judy's House, a safe complex offering resources, protection, and support for survivors.
Judy's legacy has also reached a wider audience through the documentary we mentioned earlier, The Fire That Took Her. This powerful film chronicles Judy's life, the horrifying attack, and her family's quest for justice. It has been shown at multiple film festivals and used in educational settings to highlight the urgent need for systemic reform in how domestic violence cases are handled. Viewers have described it as heartbreaking, but necessary, with many saying it motivated them to take action in their own communities. Through her family's efforts, Judy's story has become a beacon of hope for survivors and a call to action for society. Her voice continues to resonate, proving that even in the face of unimaginable cruelty, courage and determination can spark lasting change. Judy Malinowski's story is heartbreaking, but it's also powerful. She turned her pain into action and made sure her voice was heard. Her fight for justice has saved lives and shown others that even in the darkest moments, there's hope. If you or someone you know is experiencing domestic violence, please call the National Domestic Violence Hotline at 1-800-799-7233 or visit thehotline.org. You are not alone, and help is available.
We want to give a huge thank you to Haley Gray for her incredible research on Judy's case. Haley is truly the gold standard when it comes to ethical true crime research, and we are so grateful for the work that she's done. Be sure to follow her on Instagram at Haley Gray Research. Until next time, stay safe
and make good choices. Bye.
Bye.
FireEyes Media.
I'm Jake Deptula.
And I'm Michelle Locke.
And this is Loveless Fridays. Here we delve deeper into the topics, themes, and stories featured on Lovelessphere. Today, Michelle and I are thrilled to welcome Gina and Amber, the dynamic duo behind Weird True Crime. Gina and Amber are childhood friends who bonded over their shared love of all things goofy, creative, and spooky. Growing up immersed in the world of true crime, Gina spent Friday nights watching Dateline with her mom, while Amber was hooked on Unsolved Mysteries and Rescue 911.
Now, as moms juggling their love of true crime with raising families, Gina and Amber have turned their lifelong passion to a podcast that's perfect for the fans for the weird, the wacky, and of course, true crime. Where true crime covers everything from lesser-known cases and unsolved murders to spooky stories and often offbeat news headlines.
On their show, Gina and Amber covered the tragic murder of Judy Malinowski, whose story is a harrowing example of the devastating effects of domestic violence. Judy was a mother of two who survived unimaginable abuse at the hands of Michael Slager before being set on fire in broad daylight. Gina and Amber, thank you so much for joining us. What was it about Judy's case that made you both want to cover it?
Well, it's a monumental case in legal history. Judy's the first victim to testify against her murderer, and the pain she endured for those 696 days, while all of the odds were stacked against her, is a testament to how strong she was and how important it was for her to set this example for her daughters.
Exactly as Gina said, having the victim testify at her own murder trial was unprecedented. And luckily, there wasn't a law in Ohio prohibiting testimony from a victim of homicide before, you know, they actually passed away. She endured absolute unfathomable pain, but she used her pain to drive her to keep going every single day so she'd be able to help victims in situations that she had found herself in.
This is such a tragic case on so many levels. And because it's rooted in domestic violence, which we talk about on Loveless Fear, on Loveless Fridays, based on all the information that you know and what you've done to cover this case and really dive in and share this with your audience, what are some of the red flags that you picked up on Judy and Michael's relationship?
I think one of the biggest red flags that I noticed at the very beginning was the fact that Judy and Michael had known each other for a decent amount of time. There had been some time where he had gone to prison, and when they reconnected, it was almost instantaneous. He essentially moved in with her, and they were inseparable. For me, that was a red flag. She hadn't been entirely aware of his past criminal history. Mm-mm. So she wasn't thinking to look out for anything like that. But him attaching himself to her so strongly, so quickly, the way that he did was the first red flag that I realized.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, he's inserting himself into her life so fully, so quickly, that it's not really giving her a chance to maybe see some of those signs or realize that there might be a danger or a threat there. And not to mention that once he had basically moved himself in with her, he's belittling her. He's talking down to her. He's saying things to her that make her feel less than. And all that does is make her feel worse about herself. And when you put somebody in a situation like that, they feel like they're not really worth anything else and they're not going to find anything better. So they're going to stay there because this is the only person that's going to stay with them when they have these quote unquote flaws.
Right. No one will love them like the abuser does. And they believe it. They do. They think they can't do any better. When he moved in like that and really took control of her life and started with the derogatory name calling and the insult, I mean, he started from his path of destruction from the very beginning and just kept belittling her, controlling her, giving her no other escape until she had no choice but escape through drugs. And that's one of the reasons why I believe she relapsed.
Oh, absolutely. And then he saw that as another opportunity to control her, right? Because she relapsed, but she also continuously fought to get sober again. And he would just continue to come back and keep giving her those drugs to keep her under the influence.
Yeah, it's hard to make clear, concise decisions when you're under the influence all the time.
There were so many red flags, and that didn't even involve the more physical aspects of the abuse.
What were some of the little things that ended up escalating into bigger things?
I think the call 911 repeatedly. You wouldn't think that's a big one, but when you get to a race to the phone to who gets to call 911 first and who gets to pitch their side of the story first, that's really something that people should pay attention to. Because that race to the phone to call 911 and to pitch their story is something that can be absolutely an indicator of the person's true motive. Especially if you're sitting there knowing you didn't do anything wrong. Like, I've had a couple of cases where both parties, the cops actually testified to this at one of our hearings, that both parties opened cabinet doors into their own foreheads and then raced to call 911 to create the story.
What's different about this case is because Michael, the abuser, as you mentioned, was using the authorities in order to control her. And Michael was savvy enough to craft the narrative that Judy was the issue. So he was already covering his tracks well early into his abuse.
And not to mention that she's got to be worried about her kids, right? If she's the one who calls or if she gets in trouble and she gets arrested, where are her kids going to be? So it puts her in an extra vulnerable position because not only is she dealing with this abuser who's using his control over her and calling the cops to make her look like the bad guy, she's struggling with a drug addiction that he's helping her keep and trying to maintain the ability to keep her kids. So it's a lose-lose situation.
It's a lose-lose. And that's why, you know, people always get to the question of, well, why didn't she just leave? And far too often, victims face this dreaded question. It's, well, why didn't you just leave? I mean, Judy's case is a perfect example of it, of unpacking why leaving an abusive relationship is far more complicated than it seems, because it really, really is. According to the National Domestic Violence Hotline, on average, it takes a victim 7 times to leave before staying away for good. There are infinite reasons why someone would have a difficult time leaving. Fear is usually a big one. Leaving a relationship, an abusive one, leaving is the most dangerous time. And so it's really important in those particular cases to work with experts for a safety plan. And those have to be as well thought out as possible. The other problem that really comes is the abuse becomes their norm. They don't know anything else. And they think that that's normal. And that's how all relationships are. Then you run into shame, which is, I'm a smart, intelligent, capable person. How could I let this happen to me? And you don't want to go admit to your family that you were the victim of abuse and that you suffered at the hands of someone. And it's the shame of feeling like a failure, of I let this happen to me. And that shame's a huge one. Also intimidated, and that could be financial resources. That could be, if you leave, you're leaving the children with me. Or if you leave, I'm taking custody of the kids, you'll never see them again. If you leave, here's the consequence of that. I can't tell you how often children are used as, I didn't want to leave because he threatened to take the kids away from me, or she threatened to take the kids away from me. And then low self-esteem. If you have lived in fear, abuse has been normalized, then you clearly have a warped self-esteem because of what you've been through, right? I mean, you may have already gone into the relationship with low self-esteem, but an abusive relationship drives your self-esteem even lower. And so all of those types of things can absolutely make it difficult for someone to leave. And it's real easy to say, well, if they just asked, there is no shame and I would have helped them, but it's just not that easy.
It's not. And something I've also learned through these cases and then personal relationships that I have is a lot of the times these people are in these relationships with these controlling, gaslighty, manipulative people. And then they say, well, why am I the problem? What did I do wrong? And they come to the point where they think that it's their fault, right? So they're the ones to blame. And they apologize and they're asking, well, am I crazy for feeling like I didn't do anything wrong here? What did I do? What should I be doing differently so this person isn't treating me this way? Obviously, I did something to cause this. And you see it all the time. And because of these feelings of guilt, you're also just going to go back to this abuser out of shame because they make you feel like you did something wrong.
She may have been thinking that this is the only man that will tolerate me. I'm an addict. I can't go to anyone else. Basically, she was self-isolating in a way because he was creating this atmosphere that really she was never going to get an equal hand from anyone.
I have to say, Judy's story is really just, and it made me cry for lots of reasons, but the shame that she must have felt falling off the wagon, the shame that she felt knowing that she was in a bad relationship and had no escape, I can't imagine just what a burden that was on her. The fact that she overcame it after suffering those severe, severe injuries showed her resilience and showed that despite what she went through with what burns over 90% of her body and enduring more than 59 surgeries, that somehow she let go of that shame, which was to me the victory for her. I mean, it wasn't a victory in the sense that she got to live, but she got part of herself back by doing it. And I do believe that's what helped her live as long as she did, because she took herself back. It gives me chills just thinking about it.
And I mean, it was a miracle that she survived so long based on suffering burns 90% of her body, 59 surgeries. I mean, just unhuman ability to survive. Okay, absolutely, against every single odd in the book. Her being able to testify in this way, how much would that testimony weigh based on everything that she's gone through and everything that she's able to share based in the condition? How does a court see that?
Her testimony was, for me, it's a prosecution's best case and a defense attorney's worst nightmare for so many reasons. Quite frankly, I've always talked about when I try cases, I keep it as a KISS method, keep it simple, stupid. If I was a prosecutor in her case, I would have played that video and then put on probably the autopsy and the other things you have to do to meet the elements in the indictment. But what else do you need other than that recording? And from a defense attorney's position, what are you supposed to do with that? The only thing you can do is say, well, she was under the influence, either at the time it happened, and so she didn't remember that she actually caused it to herself. I mean, whatever story they can come up with, or it's she's remembering wrong because of all the trauma she's had. Those are the only ways to attack it. But the problem is, then you run the risk of really making the jury angry because you see this woman who, I mean, completely disfigured. And if you know anything about burns, and I would suspect the prosecutor did this, if you know anything about burns, they are horrific. I mean, horrifically painful. You actually lose liquid from your burns. And so you're constantly dehydrated. Like, and people that are too burned, like have water literally oozing from them. It's just horrific. The state probably went into some details about that to show how she suffered. I mean, that'd be important for punishment phase for sure. That's the kind of evidence in court that silences a courtroom. And it's deafening silence. I've been in a courtroom when the death sentence is read.
Yeah.
And I've never heard a silence like that ever. I would imagine that when this testimony was played, it was that.
We talk about how there are clues to these situations, right? But one of the problems, and we all know this, is that if you're a victim in these situations, you become an expert in concealing things, right? you survey people around in your environment and whatnot. And we're all pretty open here, but there's also things in our life, I'm sure, that don't come out, and we don't want to make someone feel uncomfortable, or we don't want someone basically telling us what to do. When you go down that path and you look at the isolation and the escalation, even the fact that Judy tried to stay in a hotel just to get away from him, and he ended up finding her a few days later and coerced her into coming home. Michelle, you see these situations all the time.
Listen, I've lived it. And that's why the shame one gets to me, because the shame really keeps you silent. It really does. And there's not an easy fix for that. How do you take away someone's shame? How do you take away that they feel like they're worthless because they let themselves do things they wouldn't have done? How do you fix that? It's the only the person that can fix that. And sometimes you're just not capable. That's why I love Judy's story, because she forgave herself and got over the shame. But that shame leads to silence every time.
Actually, Michelle, I have a question for you.
Yeah.
Because I feel like there's so many different layers to the word shame, right? Mm-hmm. You can be ashamed of so many different aspects of a relationship. You can be ashamed of the fact that it didn't work out the way you thought it would. You can be ashamed of the fact that this person you fell in love with is not who you thought they were. From your experience, what do you think it is that impacts a person in that situation the most? And like, is there something specific that helps them kind of power themselves through to get out of that situation? Or is that something that's hard to get past?
Kind of like how love bombing is. I think people's shame is unique to each individual, because what is so shameful to one person may not have the same effect as someone else. But let's say for 20 years, you've had this image of the perfect marriage and the perfect kids and the white fence and half the stuff we see on Facebook from our friends, right? Like, their lives are perfect. And for some of those people, the shame of everyone finding out that it's a farce, that they rent their house, their kids are drug addicts or flunking out of school, that they're about to be kicked out of their house. And I can think of a housewife that's an example of that. But the shame of that would be enough to keep them from ever telling about what's going on behind. And I think for Judy, I can only guess, and it's an educated guess, but I would suspect that her relapse was her real shame that made it difficult for her to get out. Because she had really gotten sober and gotten clean. And if you've worked that hard for something and you completely fall off of it, that shame may have been enough for her to not tell her family. Because then it's you're a two-time loser again. And no one wants to be that. And that's why, you know, my whole philosophy in life is everyone should get second chances. You never know what someone's been through. You never know what their life experiences are to get them to the point where they're at. And sometimes that grace and just telling them that it's going to be okay and they can get out of it, they can pull forward, they can become better. Because sometimes in life, it just takes one person believing in you to make a difference.
That's really well said. Gina and Amber, based on the research that you've done and everything that we've seen and heard, do you have any better sense of who Judy was as a person, what her dreams were, what she was looking for when it came to a relationship? Came to love, support?
She was really wanting to focus on bettering herself and focus on her daughters. With the split, with the scandal that happened with her husband, Ron, she wasn't exactly looking for anything else. She wanted to get through the cancer treatments, survive that, and just make the absolute best life that she possibly could for her two daughters. There was a quote that she had said that I cannot remember off the top of my head, but it was so poetic. It just instantly gives you the sense that her kids were her entire world and they were her focus. She wanted to just make everything possible for her kids.
You know, she was such a hero on so many levels. And the fact that her legacy lives on through Judy's Law, I want us to kind of break down the legal aspects to Judy's case. And Michelle, I want to get your thoughts on these. Judy becoming the first person in Ohio to testify in her own murder trial from her hospital bed. Explain how groundbreaking that this testimony worked and its significance.
Every defendant, criminal defendant, has the right to confront their accusers. And because it was testimony from the hospital bed, it wasn't quite the same as what I think a lot of people had envisioned as your right to confront your accuser. Also, she's speaking from the grave, which makes it hard to cross-examine. Although, if I recall correctly, weren't the defense attorneys allowed to cross-examine her in the hospital room, if I recall correctly?
So, yeah, she recorded a deposition where she had to be slowly weaned off of the pain medicine and had to be sworn in under oath. She was first questioned by the prosecution. It was like over an hour long deposition. And then like the second half of it, the defense was able to speak with her and question her.
And just so you know, an hour long deposition is not a long deposition. I sat in one for 6 hours yesterday. Did the court limit the time they could ask her?
This is coming from the released video of the deposition that the public was able to see. But I want to say that the deposition actually lasted hours. But yeah, what was actually released that you could see and watch and hear was a little over an hour or so.
I think it was 3 hours. And
yes,
the cross-examination was like two-thirds of it.
I watched the documentary on it. And I think people were complaining about the cross-examination because they were really unmerciful. But you've got to be really careful as a defense attorney what kind of questions you are asking someone in that kind of position, especially someone that didn't do it to themselves. I mean, it's not like she lit herself on fire at the gas station, but it's groundbreaking because, like, at least in Texas, we have dying declarations. So dying declarations are an exception to the hearsay rule. And what the hearsay rule's general rule says is you can't say use an out-of-court statement for the purpose of the truth of the matter asserted, which in her testimony, it would have been an out-of-court statement absolutely for the truth of the matter asserted that he did it. So it makes it groundbreaking for that reason in Ohio. And you know what's interesting to me is that it doesn't seem like it should have been groundbreaking. To me, it's kind of common sense. But you know, with how the rules of evidence work in different states and how things happen, it's just... But something like that should happen. If you've got someone that's dying, yeah, you should be able to take their deposition. But I know, at least in criminal cases, especially in Texas, you have to ask the court, I think, for permission to take depositions. Unlike in civil cases where you can just notice the deposition, say, hey, we're taking a deposition on this date. In criminal cases, you have to go seek the permission of the court to do so.
After Judy passed away, Michael pleaded guilty to aggravated murder and was sentenced to life without parole. His plea agreement stipulated that the death penalty would be off the table. Michelle, how much of an effect did Judy's wishes have on this decision?
When you've got a criminal, the prosecutors typically confer with victims about their desires for punishment before they make plea deals. I think that her wishes had an absolute impact on the prosecutor, because I think a prosecutor looking at that case, to me, like in Texas, that had been an automatic death penalty case. I mean, it just would have been. It's not even a doubt in my mind that it would have been a death penalty case. That being said, I think it was only not a death penalty case because that's what Judy wanted. I mean, I think the prosecutor took it 100% into consideration when they made the offer, because quite frankly, someone that could do that to her needs to be like drawn up and quartered.
Mm-hmm. I do want to add though that Michael wanted to plead no contest. So he wanted to plead. I'm not saying I didn't do it. But the prosecutor said, no, if you want this plea deal, you have to plead guilty. And that's why he pleaded guilty, not because he wanted to plead guilty.
Where does this leave us with Judy's legacy? What can we learn from her case, from her situation, and everything that she's gone through, and ultimately everything that she's helped to provide to potentially future survivors of anything that has happened during her life?
The most appropriate takeaway from Judy's case is really her own words, which are, if you're in an abusive relationship, find help and get out completely. Run the other way. Run. I'll add to that and run as fast as you can. I think that's the takeaway. Get out. It's difficult. It's hard. It may seem impossible, but she got out even after she got burned.
Gina and Amber, what was the one thing that made you both want to cover and explore Judy's life, her case, and ultimately the outcome?
I mean, the woman was set on fire from head to toe, and she survived that. She survived way, way longer than anybody ever expected her to. They actually have a formula for calculating mortality for burn victims. I don't know the exact formula, but they take your age and the percentage of your body that's burned. And her being in her early 30s when she had been burned, and that she was burned over 90% of her body, her mortality rate was 110%. And through sheer determination, this woman stayed alive for 2 years to help bring justice to her abuser and to be kind of this beacon for other women going through her situation. Anytime that we're researching a case, anytime we're looking at stuff, I kind of do a shallow dive, read through basic information. You know, we also want to make sure that there's enough out there to really be informative about it. And in just doing the shallow research into it, one thing that really stuck out to me was burn injuries are horrendous.
They're absolutely horrific.
The recovery, the treatment, everything that is involved with burn patients is just excruciating.
To bring the skin, disinfecting the skin, I mean...
And it's constant. Skin grafts, surgeries.
And it's every day. It's every single day.
We mentioned in the episode that when you're burned, your nerves are exposed. Mm-hmm. And there is literally no amount of medicinal relief that you can get unless you're knocked out. And she had been in a coma for quite a while. Long story short, the thing that really stuck out to me was after she had woken up from her coma and she saw herself for the first time in a mirror, it had been 2 months since the attack occurred. And she said the moment that she saw herself, she knew she had to stay alive to keep going to help other women. That part, this isn't even, we're not even counting the 2 times that she beat cancer. We're not even going into all of that. It's that. She saw what had been done to her and used that to push herself through something that most people wouldn't have survived a few months.
A day. Yeah. Not to mention that, I think they would have had to give her so much pain medication to actually dull the pain that it would have killed her. So she was always in pain. So even when she was on the high doses of medication, she was still in immense pain. And then imagine having to come off all of that over weeks of time to be able to prove to a judge that you're of sound mind to testify. So, I mean, the mental strength that this woman had to put herself through all of that just to show her daughters, like, this is what you do. Like, I'm going to fight and I'm going to stand up for myself in this situation. I'm going to stand up for other women who have been in this situation. The role model that she was for her daughters in that moment. And the other reason why I think this story is so important is if you're not in the situation, if you've never been in a relationship like this, or you don't know anybody who's been in a relationship like this, it's really easy to ignore it or not understand how dangerous it can be.
And don't ever tell someone, why don't you just get out?
Right.
Don't ever say that. No. Don't ever say that. Mm-mm. Your only thing you should say is, how can I help you get out?
How can I help?
Mm-hmm.
Do we know how her kids are now?
They're young adults. They work for the foundation. They do all sorts of advocacy work and everything else.
They must be amazing. And looking back, they have got to know what a hell of a woman their mother was.
Mm-hmm.
So Kaylin is the oldest daughter. When Judy was still in the hospital and they were trying to push Judy's law through, Kaylin actually went before a judge and spoke basically on behalf of her mom to try to help get this. And she didn't want to speak in front of all of these strangers of all, you know, it's a very serious setting too. Courtrooms scare the hell out of me. And she was 13 at the time.
Mm-hmm.
So her mother's influence had already started back then when she was that much younger.
Well, I would suspect that Judy is looking down on them and smiling. Y'all are going to make me cry on a Friday. It's already been a crap week. It's like the ugliness in this world that exists sometimes just sucks.
But you know what, though? It's so easy to ignore it and not talk about it because it is ugly and dark and it sucks. But that's where the problem is, right? Because the more you ignore it, the less people understand that it's important and it needs to be talked about and understood, because people need to know what to do in these situations and how to fight.
I agree.
And the people that love those people need to know how to help them.
It's But I think why Jake does what he does is why I do what I do, why Haley does what she does, and why you guys do what you do.
Yep.
What does the future hold for Weird True Crime? How can people get involved? How can people find the show? How can they listen? Can they suggest cases? Are there any things out there that you want to accomplish in this next year?
I mean, there's so many goals we want to achieve, right? Like, of course, we want to work with more families. And we have several families that we're in the process of working with to cover their stories. And these are stories that get no media attention, no police coverage, nobody will touch it. And these are just families that are stuck looking for answers and nobody's willing to help them. And it's so frustrating. And so the fact that they want to come talk to us and so we can provide them a platform to tell their story and get the word out there is so important, because the more that we can talk about this and get it in front of people, it's going to push law enforcement to take action, because they don't like it when other people are calling them out on what they're not doing.
From this standpoint, Haley, can I bring you into the conversation for this real quick? What kind of impact do you hope to make by what you're doing in producing and researching many of these cases in the true crime space?
The main goal is to help families spread awareness of their loved ones' cases. Most of the time I do unsolved, which means that we're helping the public learn about the case or putting pressure on law enforcement or both. But then sometimes I help families with solved cases, like Moms of Mysteries just covered Peggy Klinke's case, which we talked about on last week's episode. I was able to work with Peggy's sister, Debbie. And of course, Peggy's case is solved, but it's a really important one to tell because it talks about stalking awareness and National Stalking Awareness Month and things like that. So that is more about spreading awareness than putting pressure on police, but it's still just as important. And I think that it also gives credibility to the podcast I work for, because we're not just regurgitating things that we find online, which I don't have a problem with that, but we are adding to the story and doing our own reporting. And I really like that aspect of things. And then the other thing that I really like is that we're able to fact check things with families. A lot of the time the media gets things wrong. So when you work with families, you're able to have them fact check everything. And then you know that the content you're putting out there is 100% accurate. And that also means a lot to families, because they want a true narrative out there. And they also want to talk about the things that the media has gotten wrong. I think working with families is the best thing to do. And if people aren't doing that, they should certainly look into doing that, because it is really important for families to have a voice. I mean, these are their stories.
Gene and Amber, you both dive into uncomfortable things in the true crime space, okay? I'm not saying true crime cases are comfortable, but we all know that there's a certain level of the, let's say, the popular or the well-known cases that people gravitate towards because
there's the shiny ones.
Exactly. This is not one of those cases that is going to make people feel good.
You don't walk away from this case feeling good about yourself or good about civilization. You don't.
You both could have chosen certain cases, certain topics that, let's just say, would have been more lower hanging fruit, more comfortable. But you both dive into things that people not only need to hear, but put them in a position to become very uncomfortable in the true crime space. So I want to talk to you both about that and find out why you decide to choose cases which are a little bit of a more difficult target to hit.
It's important to tell the hard stories. It's important to not just tell the stories that everybody wants to hear, because a lot of the time we know what happened in those. And there are so many families out there that are still looking for answers or justice or trying to find their loved one or fight for their loved one who was murdered 30 years ago and the cops still won't solve it.
When Gina and I are discussing what cases to cover, we have a running list. I'm real big on balance, on having a variety. Advocacy is super important. Families of victims, they need help with their voice. They need a platform, and we can do that for them. But there's also these other cases, you know, especially with Judy's case. Yeah, it's uncomfortable as hell to talk about. But what if there is somebody out there that's listening, that is thinking, oh God, that kind of sounds like what, you know, my boyfriend's doing to me. It shows them that Judy may not have gotten out the way that she wanted to or that she deserved to, but there was a way for her to get out. I look at Judy's case not as just this tragic, tragic story. I think of it as more of the perfect example of somebody showing unwavering strength and resilience in an impossible situation. Hearing that aspect, hearing that side of these cases can give you hope. It can help you when things just feel absolutely bleak. You can hear somebody else going through something like that, and it can give you hope that, one, you're not alone, and two, there are things that can be done. There are people that are listening.
Thank you for joining Gina, Amber, Michelle, Haley, and I on Loveless Fridays. If you have a dating or relationship story to share or want to participate in a discussion here on Loveless Fridays, DM me on Instagram at lovelessfearpod or email me at lovelessfearpod@gmail.com. Thanks for listening, sharing, and supporting. Links to guest social media and some content mentioned are in our show notes. If you know someone who's being abused by a partner, there is help available. 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, 365 days a year. The National Domestic Violence Hotline provides essential tools and support to help survivors of domestic violence so they can live their lives free of abuse. Call 1-800-799-SAFE. That's 1-800-799-7233 or text START to 88788.